welcome inside the Crazy Ant Farm, man. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. Thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, of course, of course. And we should say good morning, sir. You are the first guest that we have ever interviewed when it's the next day already. So yeah, that's a first for us.
It's morning for us here. We're one day ahead, and it's 10 a.m. here in Sydney, Australia.
Yeah, well, all right. We love that. That's going to be fun. And thank you for joining us this morning. I know Logan, he is just pumped. He's a camera guy on our crew, our film. And this is going to be a fun one. It's going to be a fun one. But how we like to start it off is we always kind of want to do a little intro for the guests. I mean, for the listeners and everything about how you kind of got started in the industry. Because we're always really curious about, was it something that you always saw yourself doing? Did you know it was always going to be a film career? Was that the dream? Did you kind of fall into it a little bit, just kind of random? How did it get started?
Well, I'll keep it short, but I started off with a passion for stills photography. I was given a camera when I was very young, and I just taught myself to learn about film and processing. And I just had this love for photography. I then managed, one way or the other, to get a job at a local television station, and I was there for a number of years and eventually became a news cameraman there. At the time, you know, I was like 21 years old, and I was, you know, a qualified news cameraman. I kind of felt I needed to explore the world a bit more, so I resigned. I was lucky enough to be accepted to go to film school in Los Angeles at the American Film Institute. And I spent a year or so there, and I had the best time learning from the masters. I made great friends. I got to understand how the industry works. And then I came back to Australia and initially worked as a camera assistant for a number of years. But, you know, I was kind of missing my passion of, you know, being behind the camera. So I then used my TV contacts. And I ended up shooting, you know, lots of documentaries. I worked for 60 Minutes. I just kept working, kept shooting, to the point where I ended up shooting TV promos and then commercials internationally. And then the commercials led to more long form work. And that's how I ended up here shooting high-end TV series and streaming projects, as well as feature films.
Oh, that is absolutely brilliant. And I love that too, because, you know, there's so many different examples of creatives like yourself and like us who always say, just do something, get a camera in your hand, no matter what the budget is, no matter how many hours it is, be sure to stay creative, because continuing to flex that creative muscle, to continue to learn about different angles, learn about lighting, learn about your ISO, all of these different things, they help you in the long run establish yourself. And then plus along the way, you come in contact with people who you feel like, you know, are able to bring with you, or you are able to bring on the next project, or to, you know, utilize that contact to where maybe they're on something and they think of you because there's another position that is needed to be filled. So it's all of these different types of things that is very influential in your craft, right? And how you continue moving forward. And it's all about the connectability and being a likable person too, because I mean, if you come off kind of as an asshole, nobody's really going to want to work with you. Yeah. So, I mean, talk about that a little bit. Utilizing your contacts in the sense of, you know, being a young up-and-comer who, you know, is making connections through either the commercial game or through the television game. How do you utilize those contacts to bring you forth to that next process? Because a little bit of a story for us, that's how we started working together. We started utilizing our contacts in the television game to make, you know, hey, I like your house, so let's shoot in your house, or like those type of things. So how do you do that in your industry or in your neck of the woods?
No, I think that's a really good point. And it's important for young filmmakers to understand that it's part of the training process. You know, when I was young and trying to build up my reel to present to commercial companies, you know, I had to scrape together I had to beg for short ends. I had to go to the lab and ask them to process my film for nothing. You know, I had to, you know, it's so much easier these days. You know, you can get an SLR camera or even an iPhone. You can cut it on your computer. You can compose the sound, the music. You know, it's like, it's there's no, the only thing that's stopping you is your own motivation that, now.
Yeah.
It was difficult at the time, but in the process, I think of going through this, you meet like-minded people. My big thing was a friend of mine that was a television editor, and he wanted to be a director. I was a TV cameraman. I wanted to be a cinematographer. So we combined our resources, and you know, I took care of all the camera stuff. He took care of all the post-production. And we were making projects together that way. And it was only just the two of us. And then we kind of scraped together a few other people to help us. And, you know, that was, I can say without a doubt, you know, doing those projects helped me get my commercial career running. And then it gets kind of easier in a way. You know, you've got other people paying the bills.
Right.
you've got support, you know, got a great crew around you, you know, it does get easier. But it's all about just creating, becoming part of a filmmaking community, reaching out to like-minded filmmakers. And even if they're not directly involved in that particular field, you know, you might be a stills photographer, but, you know, you can pick up an SLR, you can learn how to shoot motion picture. You know, it's kind of, it's really up to the individuals and how they can initially network to get people, like-minded people together, and then just take it further. And you end up with an end result that can help you get some, you know, paying jobs. And it also teaches you how to communicate on set, how to build those contacts, how to retain those contacts, which is exactly what you need when you're working professionally and later in your career. It's all about nurturing the contacts that you've made, nurturing new contacts. You know, I'm still networking today. It's part of the job.
Yeah. Well, you know, a couple of things there. So much to unpack right there. I want to go back just a little bit, because the one thing that you said that really jumped right as you said it, and I think it's so critically important, that you were 21 and you said, I got to go explore the world. There's more out there. I got to do it. I think it's so important for young people to understand that that's the time to do it, when you're in your 20s, when you're like, wait, don't lock that. I think there's so much societal expectation put on people about you have to have this at this age, and you have to be this by this age or this by. Man, the 20s is when you figure it out. That's when you get out there and try everything. So to take the leap at 21 and know that that's, I got to get out there, I got to see what I want to do, I got to find out what else is out in the world, I thought that, everybody, priceless advice for everybody out there trying to figure it out. That's the first thing. Take the leap and get out of your comfort zone. And then the other that I wanted to follow up on is what you were saying about, it's one thing to do the networking, right? You got to network, you got to get there, you got to know this person, that person, and know how to use them and get where you want to go. But it's also about fostering the relationship and maintaining those relationships, because it isn't just about a one and done, or, you know, it's maintaining and fostering those relationships, because as we said, it is a really small community. And if you build a relationship with these people, that's going to be something that continues over the years, and that's going to lead to this, to this, to this, to this. And I think that's so critically important for the people trying to break into the industry. So I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think a lot of times that they don't really teach that, especially if you don't go to film school or you don't, nobody teaches you about the networking part of it, the importance of building the community part of it, right? And that's when you struggle, is when you don't have those like-minded people and that community around you. And so I just love that you brought that up. So do you find yourself, when you were working as the AC, and are you under that mindset of when you're on a set and you know, hey, I know I can do that. I know I can do this. Do you start like, hey man, can I get behind the camera? Can I see what you're doing here? Can I ask this? Can I ask that? Do you find yourself in those like, hey, do you mind if I too? Because I think right, if you don't have an ego and you know that there's always more to learn, there's always more to that you can grow with, and if you ask questions and you find like-minded people that are willing to answer and willing to say, sure, come on over here, jump behind the camera. Do you find yourself in that position, and as a cinematographer, are you like that? Are you willing to give advice to somebody who might have the courage to ask you, can I look behind the camera and see what you're doing?
Absolutely. I mean, I work with a lot of ACs on every job. There are different crews, different ACs from different countries. The ones that stand out are the ones that are going to pull you aside, you know, in the lunch break, or want to have a conversation about, you know, things. And, you know, you can tell, you know, their brain is ticking over. They're watching, they're observing, they're learning. You know, it's not just a job and they're going through the motions. You know, they're interested. And then I'm interested in what they're doing, you know. Like an example, you know, my daughter is an actress. Her boyfriend is a filmmaker. You know, I spend a lot of time speaking with him and with her about what's relevant, you know,
sure,
today, these days, you know, from a music point of view, from the films that they're watching. You know, it's kind of like important for me to ask those questions of them, as important as it is for them to ask questions from me, coming from a different perspective. But, you know, it's all part of communicating, sharing ideas, and kind of letting the craft evolve.
Mm.
Getting back to what you were saying previously as well, what also came to mind when we were talking about networking, what I found very interesting, and I think up-and-coming people should remember this, there are often executive producers that I work with today who I remember were receptionists at production companies, or couriers, or junior, you know, junior runners or whatever, you know. And I always, you know, I mean, I like everyone, you know. I chat to people, and they often say, oh, you were so nice to me in those days, you know, like, and they're the ones employing me today. So I think it's important to treat everyone with respect, irrespective of, you know, their age and their position. They may be able to help you in the future, but it's just part of the film. You know, we're all part of that filmmaking community.
Oh,
and I think that's really important to remember.
Love that.
Yeah, most definitely. And I mean, something else too that I feel like not a lot of creatives talk about is, you know, having a full-fledged career, like making commercials. Because one of our favorite guests that we've had on the show, his name is Brent Bailey. And this man has made a living off of being the spokesperson for
Shell.
Yep. And the spokesperson for, you know, like different car rental companies and different things like that, to where, you know, you're making a very sustainable living just doing this. So, I mean, talk about that a little bit, too, because, you know, I feel like some people neglect that side of the entertainment industry because they feel like it's beneath them, so to speak. So, I mean, yeah, what are your thoughts on that? And how do you, you know, pick and choose what type of job that you continue to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the great thing about the industry is that as a cinematographer, you know, you can go from news, documentaries, reality TV, commercials, feature films, whatever, you know, like there's a lot of opportunities there. And I've always looked at my career as a marathon, you know, like I'm not interested in doing anything else. So when my children were both young, you know, I was hesitant to commit to projects that took me away from home for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
That was my motivating factor. And I ended up becoming a very successful cinematographer, shooting primarily car commercials. So you do get, you know, even within commercials, you get pigeonholed. You do food or you do cars or whatever. And I traveled the world shooting car commercials. And it was fantastic. You know, I had a great time. I earned a very good living. But what was most interesting is that, you know, every week or every 2 weeks, I'm working with a different director,
right,
who has a different vision, often with different equipment, with a different crew, or maybe, you know, obviously different locations. So you're constantly honing your craft. You're developing the skills of communication and working with different directors, but you also have access to the latest equipment and exposure to that. So Also, a lot of the directors who are doing big things, you know, like for example, someone like Ridley Scott, you know, he's created a whole career of commercials as well. So the
Exactly.
Jonathan Glazer, you know, like there are amazing directors who have come from careers in commercials and moved into feature films, and that can happen for cinematographers as well. And you know, it's fun shooting commercials. You know, it just varies from week to week, and I really enjoy it.
Well, I liken that because you say you use the term honing your skills. So I liken like when you take on commercial projects, you know, you're doing that, or you, like as you said, a documentary or a short form subject as opposed to a feature length or a series, right? I liken that to an actor who a screen actor that goes and does stage work. They say that that's their school. That's how they hone the craft. That's how they stay on top of the game because it's a skill that you have to continuously keep using or it gets old, it gets rusty, and you gotta. So I liken that to what you just said about, hey, I'm gonna jump on this commercial because it's a different location with a different camera and different setup, and I get to learn some stuff and I get to keep learning and growing and honing my craft. I love that idea of thinking that way and checking the ego at the door because, like you said, there's no job too small. It's you're learning, you're growing, you're sustaining, and you're doing what you love to do. How is that ever a bad thing? So the people that have that ego and are like, I don't want to do that. It's like, well, you know, maybe you're not going to do anything if you keep thinking like that, you know?
Well, every commercial is different as well. You know, some directors are very much visual directors and they have a very clear visual idea. Others are more interested in performance and they leave the visuals, you know, aside. Every job is completely different. And as most films are different and the dynamics, but with commercials, it changes often, you know, from week to week almost.
Without doubt. I have to ask because I'm an old school guy. I know Logan, me and Logan, we have a little bit of an age gap between us. So we
If you couldn't
bring both
tell, if
kind
you
of
couldn't tell.
worlds into it, right? When I first started, it was film. I mean, it wasn't digital. We weren't shooting on video. I was going reel to reel when I was editing, and it was like old school. And when it first started making the conversion to digital, and it was all going to video, and it was going to like, I was like, wait a minute, I'm not sure I like this. I don't like, you know, you can't get this, and you can't get that, and it doesn't look this, and it doesn't look that. Are you an old school guy? Did you have to go through that transition period? And were you okay with that transition period? Or were you like, I want to shoot on film. I just want to shoot on film. Talk about that a little bit, because I think a lot of the old school guys at first were like, do we want to do this whole video thing? You're never going to get what you get on film, kind of. Christopher Nolan, for example, just film. It's got to be film. I'm not going to shoot on anything else. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, like you just said, I felt the same way. I mean, initially I was hesitant to move into the digital world only because I found that there was unrealistic expectations of what digital, you know, what digital cameras could do.
Yep.
I would speak with directors or producers, and they were saying, "Well, you know, if you're shooting, you know, we could shoot this all on the Canon 5D. You know, we don't need to." You know, we don't need lighting, we don't need grips. You know, it's like you got, and it's like, yes, you can shoot and you can get an image, but it took a while for people to understand that if you wanted image quality and the filmmaking process was still the same. And now I feel like it's kind of irrelevant whether I'm shooting digital or film. The approach is the same, the language is the same. It was a bit of a transition period. I think for everyone, for directors, for producers, everyone had to kind of learn what digital filmmaking was about and what the parameters were. And now, you know, the digital cameras are so good, you know, and it's such a good way to work. I love shooting with the latest cameras. I mean, I'm not opposed to shooting film. I haven't shot film for a couple of years now. There is a beauty about the whole film process that is magical. But in saying that, I think it's the digital has evolved in such a way that those images are pretty magical as well.
Yep, Agreed.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful experience, especially when you're on like a beautiful location to shoot, you know, some amazing things you get to see, especially the ocean that is surrounding Australia, right? And I mean, and anyone but you were able to get a lot of shots on the beach. And I mean, I followed you before coming on and doing this interview, and your Instagram is filled with some beautiful shots, especially some takeaways, you know, with yourself and Glenn Powell. I thought that was hilarious, and Sydney Sweeney walking on the beach. But I mean, let's talk about that film a little bit, because it's from Sony. So how did you get involved with this project? Did you have a representative come over and recruit you, or did you find it, or how did that go about?
So, I'm living in Australia at the moment. I have representation. I have an agent in Los Angeles. This project was floating around. The director, Will Gluck, is a huge fan of shooting in Australia, and he'd shot the two Peter Rabbit films in Australia prior to this one. The production, I knew the executive producer, and she was very keen to use an Australian cinematographer. But then I understand initially that Sony and that the director wanted to bring someone, a cinematographer from the States. So my agent in America was kind of making contact with the production people and trying to sell me from that end. And then the executive producer was selling me from this end. And I ended up meeting with the director when he was here on a scout. And it just got to the point where I think they were having problems securing the person who was, being considered. And ultimately, I got the job. So based on the fact that, I have worked in America, I have lived in the States, so I have an American sort of work experience background, and I think that really helped me as well.
I mean that just goes again. It's you never know how it's going to come together, right? Yeah, I love that. That's the other beauty of our industry. You just never know. You're in the right spot at the right time, or you're in the wrong spot at the wrong time, and you still end up getting it, right? And but I think if you're good, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You have a reputation. People know you, and you're like, no, this guy shoots in Australia. He lives in Australia. If we're having a problem, this is the guy that we can go to, and he's going to get it done for us, kind of a thing. So when you build that reputation, they trust that you're able to do the job and get it done. And I think, and thank goodness it worked out the way it did, because it's absolutely stunning the way it was shot. Like Logan said, the outdoor stuff, just talk about your process a little bit, because I'm really curious about the process, because so often we're hearing that people are shoot, they want to shoot with all natural light, and they don't want to use lighting, and they don't want to use, what is your thought process on natural light versus using lighting on a scene? And do you have a specific approach when you are shooting outside or at certain times of day?
Well, specifically with this film, because it's a rom-com, the director was very, very keen for me to have a look at a bunch of reference films. And I won't mention their titles, because after watching those films, he said, I want this film to look nothing like those films. Because rom-coms have a particular, they can have a particular kind of style and look that often is maybe a little bit artificial. So what I try and do is, especially for this film, I didn't want it to feel artificial, but I also wanted to protect the actors from the harsh Australian light. And the light here in summer is the sun's very high, it's very strong, it's not particularly flattering. So my plan was to either shoot everything backlit if I had to, or use big scrims over the top of the actors, and then just let the background be natural and do its own thing. That way I felt like it was a nice combination of having finessing the foreground and the actors so that they look like movie stars, but then put them in an environment that looks natural and real rather than like artificial and like could be a blue screen or whatever.
Yep, right.
So thankfully, the cameras have this. I shot with the Alexa LF, the large format Alexa, and it had incredible latitude from exposure and the contrast, the dynamic range is incredible. So I can scrim the actors and still retain all the information in the background, and it felt like a nice combination to me. That occurred in the interiors as well. Basically, wherever I went, I always wanted to protect the actors, make them look as good as possible, make the audience kind of fall in love with them, but then at the same time, retain that natural environment. That being said, it's easier to do as you get closer and closer in a close-up or in a mid-shot, but wide shots, then they have to be scheduled in such a way where you're kind of just utilizing the lower light in the morning, and hopefully establish a look that's backlit, that looks good, and then when you go in, you can kind of finesse that lighting a little bit more.
Yeah, I could definitely see that too. And I love how you kept saying, tried to make it look as unartificial as possible. Because, I feel like when filmmakers show Australia or Sydney, it is very cookie cutter. A lot of the same stuff. I mean, a lot of the Sydney Opera House. But I mean, of course, you had that. But then you also had street perspectives, which I thought was very interesting because I had never seen a film in Australia to where they did show you walking through town. They did show you walking down the street and just getting a little bit more vibes from the community and who lives there and the people. And I thought that was brilliant in the sense of, you're getting to learn about different cultures without just learning about the big stuff that we all already know and love. So to be able to have that dynamic, I felt like was a very interesting take, especially in a rom-com, like you said, because I mean, I felt like this rom-com was so different than any other one. I mean, myself and my fiance, we went and saw the film 3 times because we just loved it so much in the
I'm
theaters.
good. The director, Will, was very he's very keen on keeping things real. Like he doesn't like green screen or any sort of thing artificial. So it was all about capturing real locations, putting those actors in the street, putting them in, like in real locations, and just trying to capture those, and just taking away from that artificial rom-com sort of world. And I think I'm glad you've notice that, because that was really an important part. Even the scenes where the scene she they get rescued in the harbor, they get pulled up into the helicopter, and then we're in a helicopter for real. We're flying around at night for real because we wanted it to be real rather than put a helicopter in the studio and kind of try and make it look real.
Exactly. That was probably my favorite scene in the whole entire film. Obviously, because of the dialogue and what that scene actually means to them as characters. But I mean, the way you shot it and the way that the strobe lights were going back and forth on their faces when they're getting rescued. And yeah, I just thought that looked immaculate. So I
Oh,
mean,
thank you.
kudos to that. And I mean, as a cinematographer myself, I look up to people like you. So I really appreciate, you showing your artistic abilities in these different types of situations because, go ahead.
Thank you for saying that. But we got very lucky in that situation because one of our production people found, like, we shot the wide shots in the harbor at night for real, with the actors swimming at 4 o'clock in the morning through the
That's
harbor.
crazy.
That was fantastic. But then we found a helicopter rescue training facility here in Sydney, at one of our smaller airports, where they have like an artificial, they have a helicopter they dump into the water, and they create waves and helicopter noise, and they train people to survive a helicopter crash, and they train the people to dive in and save them. And we went into this facility, and we used that as our kind of studio for the scenes, the closer shots of them, when they're sitting on the buoy in front of the opera house, and then when the searchlight hits them and pulls them up, all that was done within this artificial environment. And it was the only time we went into the studio. So it was,
That's really
I think
cool.
that all worked together pretty well.
Very. And so then now let's bouncing from the other side where Logan says he's the visual guy and I'm the actor guy. I have to say, I think that the relationship between the director and the cinematographer is so critically important. And I really love the shots where you set it up to where you can feel what the characters are feeling. You can you're in that. And that's a very specific mix between wide shots and close shots and how you're framing them and how for the audience to real feel it without ever realizing that they're feel why are they feeling it, right? And I said so anytime I see a director and a cinematographer able to capture that, like, holy crap, I'm nervous right now. Why am I nervous? You don't even know why you're nervous, but it's because of the way the shot just moved and you feel like you're there with them. And I love that. And I think that you did a brilliant job with that. So talk a little bit about that too, about the how you'd set up your dynamic and your relationship between you and the director. Because I think it's so critically important for the two to be on the same page with what they visually see, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the dynamic, like, this director, Will Gluck, he's brilliant. He's an incredible filmmaker. He's a very smart guy. So, when I met him at first, it was just about trying to get inside of his head and understand, how he sees these characters developing. Because a film, you need to have that character development. You need to propel the story forward. And the actors obviously do that, and it's my job to help sell that idea visually. I mean, what he wanted to do, and I think it worked very well, is combine, the connect the actors together by shooting over their shoulders and just always try and see that connection between the two. Even if you're shooting a close-up of Glenn, we're always like over Sidney Sweeney's shoulder, just so they're always like connected. But sometimes that over the shoulder is a little bit wider, so they're both in shot, but they're further apart. So we played a lot with that. Also uses of wider lenses, longer lenses, just to help isolate them from the background a bit more. The longer lens with less depth of field will really separate them from the background so that what they're saying becomes so much more powerful, more relevant. There's very little background image to kind of distract from the words. It's kind of things like that. I mean, sometimes we wanted the lighting to be moodier in the background, so it would just fall off completely. Or other times, we could kind of lift the mood with the lighting and make it feel sunnier and warmer and friendlier, and that would reflect what the actors were saying. So a combination of lenses and camera position and lighting, from my perspective, was what I was using to help propel that story.
That's brilliant.
But a lot of that also, I mean, we speak about it in pre-production, and we go into it with a plan. The specifics of the plan often changes once the actors get in the room and the director, when you look at the location and they have some ideas, and it kind of evolves. So it's good to have a plan, but it's also important to be able to deviate from that plan and be a bit more spontaneous,
And
and
that's where
maybe
that
in a position
news cameraman
where,
experience comes in.
yeah, exactly. You may end up being in a position where the sun's blasting through the window, and it's like, wow, that's perfect. We'll put them next to the window, and they can get the sun, and it's bleeding beautifully. It's backlighting their hair. It's like it's happening naturally. Sometimes you like that, and sometimes you want to avoid it. It's good just to stay open to what's to the changes that happen prior to the shoot.
Yeah, staying open to all the different possibilities. And I know Dustin doesn't want to ask this question, so I will do it. I'm just wondering, how many takes did it take for you to get that perfect shot of that prosthetic with the sand and the penis. Like, I'm just wondering, that was like, whoa, buddy. I never even imagined that could happen. But then you, my friend, you and Mr. Gluck, you put that into my head and terrified me from ever going swimming again.
Well, I want to confirm it was a prosthetic.
That's good. That's good.
But our actor did have a lot of fun with it. Yeah. Thankfully, we only, we didn't have to shoot it too many times. The actor was very comfortable presenting his prosthetic in the right way. What was fun about that scene, I think, was just the kind of embrace at the end, you know, when it's a very Australian thing to do, but to do it when you're naked, it's like, you know, Glenn Powell's reaction was like pretty spot on, I think.
Now, what type of conversation was that about what size lens are we going to have to use? How are we approaching that one?
We wanted to be sort of... we didn't want to make too big a deal out of it and be inappropriate in regards to our conversations about this prosthetic penis.
But, oh, my goodness.
We just tried to be professional, and we shot it with a couple of different sizes. And
That's fantastic.
I love that, though, man. I love that. That's so freaking great. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on the show and getting a little crazy with us and talking about this film. Like we said, we loved it and saw it in theaters multiple times. It was probably one of the only movies in recent years, to be honest, that I've seen in the theaters multiple times and like kept going back with different friend groups who haven't seen it and be like, oh, I'll go watch it again. Of course, of course. But, you know, it's all about social media right now, and your Instagram is awesome. Mm. So I definitely want to direct people your way. So where can people follow you?
If they just find me on Danny-Ruhlman, Ruhlman, and you can find me there.
Fantastic, man. Fantastic. Yeah. And you are always working. So do you have any projects coming up that you're very excited about?
I don't have anything locked in at the moment. I was I've been enjoying just watching the success of Anyone But You.
There you go.
I'm hoping that there'll be something soon, but whether that happens here in Australia or overseas, I'm not sure at this point. I'm sure I'll be working before long.
No doubt about it, because just in this interview, you can see the passion when you talk about it and how you feel about it. Like you said way back at the beginning, to bring it full circle, it's not just a job for you getting the paycheck. It's what you love to do and you're passionate about it. So yeah, the work will be there always. Man, like Logan said, just open invite anytime you want to come back. This is such a fascinating conversation to hear the process and to see how someone approaches the art and pulls off what they do. You know, it's always amazing to talk to people behind the camera and to see how it gets done. So we appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate the invitation. And anytime you want me to come back, I'm happy to continue with my perspective on things.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I love it. Well, like we said, we know you are about to start your day as we are finishing our day. So that's very awesome. You're actually a first person who we have ever interviewed from Australia. So that's really cool as well. So you're checking off a whole bunch of boxes for us. But have a great rest of your day. Thank you again so much. And we'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Oh, boy. Talk about an informative interview, man. I mean, I think this is our first below the line person. Well, this is our second, because technically Charles from a couple weeks ago, but he also acts. But this is our first strictly below the line person, behind the scene camera, behind the camera person of 2024. And I mean, what an amazing conversation from a huge movie out right now.
Yeah. And I really like. You can see, like I told him, the passion in his eyes when he's talking about it, right? And the idea that he loves to talk about it and he's willing to share what he knows and wants to ask questions about what he doesn't know and take chances and do these things. He's the perfect kind of guy that you want to be on a set with, right? Yeah. And the one thing that I really, really liked that he said is when he said, my number one goal was to protect the talent. How often do you hear that he's worried about? Because so many directors will be like, I want this shot. And he's like, the sun is going to beat down on them unbearably. We can't do that. We got to do this. So to have a guy that's so concerned about taking care of the people and getting the shot, like I said, I can't imagine a better guy to probably be on a set with working with. I mean, it's just amazing. So, yeah, so much fun, man. I love talking to passionate people.
I know. What a great conversation. What a great conversation. From the land down under, we thank you again, Danny, for coming on the show.